RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our Thursday Money Talks here at RCR, and Joel Robinson of Radical Investment, Wellington-based financial advisor, specializing in investment, running his own financial advice business. Just told you about that. He works with New Zealanders from around the country, loves working with people to understand their current circumstances before taking them in the financial direction they want to lead in. And we've had Joel quite a few times on this program, and he's back. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Good, thank you, Paul. It's an honor to be talking to such an esteemed figure as yourself again. Always enjoy our conversations.
Oh, come on. How much do I owe you for that?
Nothing. Yeah, it's a freebie.
Maybe some Bitcoin. I think you're going to educate me a bit and our listeners on Bitcoin, though some of them are probably geniuses already on that. I guess the best way to describe this is a news-led discussion on Bitcoin. And what has been in the news recently, Joel, about Bitcoin?
Honestly, in some ways, what hasn't been in the news recently about Bitcoin, Paul, there's been a lot going on. It's a topic of the obviously very topical presidential race in the US. Trump and the Republicans put some bits and pieces in their manifesto about what they're going to do in terms of support for the broader crypto industries, not just Bitcoin, but cryptocurrencies in general. There's been talk that supposedly the Democrats will as well, but to now, there's not been anything actually in writing. Some cryptocurrency sort of based executives have come out in support of the Democrats, I think perhaps more in hope that they will return the favor, but we'll see. It's going to be fascinating to play out.
Well, we know what they're like, the Democrats. Do they ever return a favor? Well, they're only calling them in all the time.
That's a good question. I'm not a political expert, so I can't give you a good answer on that one.
Do you think Kamala Harris is fully across the entire crypto landscape ecosystem? Doesn't look like it to me.
Great question. Yeah, I'm not certain. There is probably a deeper philosophical discussion there on around money in general, which I'm very keen to go through, but that's going to be beyond today. So, yeah, I'm not sure whether she herself does. Definitely there'll be people inside the Democratic Party that understand that the...
No, just tell her what to say, probably.
I imagine there's definitely a bit of that. I mean, you know, every main prime ministerial or presidential candidate's never going to be an expert on, you know, everything, are they?
Yeah, but Trump probably is because of...
More so.
He'd have to know, wouldn't he, being at that scale of business?
Yeah, from reading commentary that he's given on the subject, it does seem to suggest he has a deeper understanding of the space. One marker that can sometimes be used, or I've heard talked about a lot actually within crypto and Bitcoin circles in New Zealand, is they differentiate Bitcoin from cryptocurrency.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, it's a form of cryptocurrency, but they kind of separate it out, and so he clearly. In order to kind of to do that, either you've had to have some sort of education on why you'd separate those two out. And so
you have a guy come in and go, okay, Donald, here. And they got the little whiteboard up and it's like, okay, I think I've got it. Yeah.
All right.
Now, I heard BlackRock's name associated with with this. That sends chills up a lot of spines.
Yep.
What's been happening there?
Yeah, so it was around Jan 11th or 12th off the top of my head. It was early mid-Jan this year when the SEC, so the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, approved the first Bitcoin ETFs. So an ETF being an exchange-traded fund, pretty self-explanatory. It is a fund that is traded on an exchange.
Yeah,
In the US, there's lots of ETFs for all sorts of things. ETFs for investing into AI companies, into tech companies, into the broad market as a whole, even into specific companies. In New Zealand, we've got a few, nowhere near as many as the States. Absolutely pales in comparison.
Yeah.
And so usually when something new comes to market, it comes to market in the US first, and often other markets follow depending on demand. Now, BlackRock was one of, I think it was about 9 or 10 different fund managers that applied to have a Bitcoin ETF, meaning it's a exchange-traded fund that people can invest into. And then that fund goes and buys the Bitcoin and they store that Bitcoin, you'd expect securely, which is one of the things that has been a debate. But they currently are the largest in terms of the amount of inflow of funds into that, of all the Bitcoin ETFs that are available.
What sort of funds are we talking about? Obviously, it must be in the billions.
Yeah, so looking as of last update, they had somewhere around the 20 billion mark.
Wow. Okay.
In funds, net assets. So there's quite a few large players. Fidelity in the US, not to be confused with the insurer, New Zealand Fidelity, they're different companies. Fidelity in the US is one of the bigger ones as well, with about 10 billion. And then there's quite a few sort of smaller ones in that, several hundred million through to a couple of billion range. So all up, it's around the 50 billion mark in terms of inflow, which is enormous for, you know, a category of exchange-traded funds, of ETFs, that have only existed for pretty much bang on 8 months.
Wow.
It's actually historic.
Yeah. Oh, historic.
Yeah. Yep.
And just the beginning.
Yeah, well, it seems to be the case that it's just the beginning. Yeah, there's not too many others coming to market with new Bitcoin ETFs, because it's kind of hard to compete. You know, there's not much differentiation between them generally. But yeah, later this year, well, just recently, the SEC gave approval for Ethereum ETFs, Ethereum being the second largest cryptocurrency by market size. And the inflows into that have not been anywhere near as significant as it was to Bitcoin, but it does open the gateway for others as well.
Does that accelerate then the creation of Bitcoins, which is kind of like mining, but it's digital mining, I get that. But if you've got, what, 100,000 NVIDIA graphics cards lined up somewhere with a nuclear power station or whatever to power it, you can start cranking out more of these things and feeding them into this market. Is that how it works?
Yes and no. So, yes, you've correctly identified NVIDIA as a big beneficiary of Bitcoin mining, and other companies that provide all those microprocessors. There's a big factor alongside AI, obviously, for why those companies have grown so much. But it doesn't really change the supply rate. That's one of the quirks of Bitcoin, is that the more resources that go into mining Bitcoin, the harder it gets to mine. Built-in design of the system so that it creates a constant supply, or relatively constant. It's not a perfect, you know, level every day, but within a range, it tends to be very consistent. The caveat to that being that every 4 years, Bitcoin goes through a halving event, one of which occurred in April this year, which was in the news a bit. Essentially, at that point, it gets twice as hard to mine Bitcoin, because the rate of new Bitcoin created each day drops roughly to about half what it was previously. So
it gets to a point, Joel, does it, when you can't, it's just not possible to create any more?
That would be once the maximum supply of 21 million Bitcoin has been reached, which is forecast to be in about 116 years from now.
Okay, plenty of time. All right. Yep.
But what we will see is, it's like a really, it's a exponential, well, it's more like a logarithmic curve for those that are mathematically inclined.
We're visualizing that,
It's the rate of new creation is really quick in early years, and it really tails off because every 4 years, effectively, you know, the supply rate is halving, you know, every 4 years. So it means, you know, that new creation is going to drop off massively.
Is that the rule with all cryptocurrency?
No.
No, okay.
No, it's not. Most have no hard limit to the supply. And that is one big key differentiator for why Bitcoin has had such extreme adoption, is because, there's not that ability to just massively
endlessly
expand
create them.
Supply.
Yeah. Which devalues. That's a devaluing force then.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's like with anything, right? If suddenly it increases a lot in value, everyone wants to obtain that or produce that. I mean, metals are a great example of this, like your copper and iron and aluminium and lithium. If anyone that's listening has followed lithium prices, you know, they they shot up with all of the electrification, you know, renewable energy, electric vehicles. And then, you know, as that price goes up, all these lithium miners that maybe previously couldn't operate a mine because it was a bit unprofitable, now all of a sudden it is. And so that supply just really ramps up until you get a point where it's exceeding the demand, especially if the demand has fallen off because people aren't buying as many electric vehicles as they once were, which has kind of been the case over the last year. And so that, you know, if you've got classic economics, if you've got far more supply than you have demand, because supply's cranked up and demand's fallen, you know, that has a really negative impact on the price. And so the price plummets. And that's what we've seen with a lot of those commodities that can be easily produced, like your lithium and your copper, your aluminium, etc.
I think lithium is the third most abundant element in the universe, someone told me.
You could be right on that. Yeah, I mean, the universe might be hard to quantify for certain.
You can't mine the universe.
On Earth, well, I mean, who knows? I mean, there could be a planet out there that's made entirely of gold, for all we know.
Yeah, there probably is.
Yeah. Or a whole blooming universe of planets. There's so many blooming universes out there. Lithium is quite abundant on Earth.
I was just thinking that Bitcoin is sort of like physical gold because there's a limitation on the accessibility of gold as well. Once you've taken all the low-hanging gold and dredged through the easy-to-find nuggets, it gets more and more difficult to get to the gold. So it's kind of like that physical process, yeah.
Yeah, it's likened a lot to being digital gold. It's kind of, I guess, the simplest way to kind of give it, to explain it without having like a one-hour conversation on it. And so often, you know, in media it gets referred to as digital gold. Similarly, gold is one of the more difficult, you know, resources to mine and to bring up out of the earth. And the other thing about gold, which is very similar to Bitcoin, is the longevity of it. So like a lot of metals tarnish, you know, they corrode over time, whereas gold is virtually indestructible. It is a very, very persistent metal. And so, you know, all of the gold or vast majority of gold that has ever been mined in history, if not all of it, is still in existence in some way, shape, or form somewhere today. Yep. Might be buried in some, you know, treasure spot somewhere that no one's found.
Mm.
But, you know, there's a lot of gold out there that has been around for, you know, centuries, which is quite different to many others. So,
yeah, how deep do you have to go to get it? That's the thing, isn't it? Because it's a heavy metal. Gravity will do its thing too. And I believe gold is created, here we go, know-it-all, at the core of supernova explosions.
Because could be right on that.
That's where that element is made. It takes those pressures and that energy to do it. So that's why it's rare.
Yep. You know, yeah, well, it's to date, no one's had really any success in trying to synthesize it out of nothing. You know, if people...
That'll be why.
if technology increased such that, you know, it became possible in time, then that would really, you know, undermine gold's longer-term
value.
But for now, we're quite far away from that being a thing.
Yeah. So this sort of, would we call it a rush to crypto now? Is that what these ETFs signify?
A little bit. It's probably more an onboarding of people that previously wouldn't have been able to, or it would have been too tough to get access. And there's a few good examples of this when you look at the traditional financial advice world, which I can attest to being in that. Most companies don't want to go down the route, which has often been fraught with issues of, you know, stolen funds, like with the collapse of FTX in the US and that complete and utter shambles of a company. In New Zealand, we had
it was stolen, wasn't it?
Yep. And Cryptopia, which used to operate in Christchurch. That was my first foray with about $20.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those funds got stolen. But the issue there was essentially the funds were centralized, stored on some location that wasn't really that well secured. Someone basically got the credentials to access that location. And you know, it's like if you left your password to your bank account, lying out in the street, it wouldn't be so much the fault of the bank that your money's gone. It's your own, you know, poor process there.
That must have been a horrifying moment of realization to see that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your heart,
especially if you had a lot of money there,
guts hit the floor.
Yep. It would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because of how difficult it has been historically to reliably access cryptocurrency in general for like the traditional finance world, it was really the first, the creation of these Bitcoin ETFs was the first opportunity for a lot of your traditional investment managers and fund managers to be able to buy it really easily within the existing architecture that exists.
Right. Yeah. Is it like being a bank in a way? Because you've got what, the crypto stored somewhere, and that's there for whoever's the investor is, right? And that crypto goes up in value, of course, and their investment goes up in value. Presumably they own those actual coins. Is that what they're called? Coins. So yep. It's kind of a quasi-banking situation, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. It's so the ETF issuer, which is like your BlackRock or your Fidelity, et cetera, they provide essentially the structure for people to invest money into that ETF. That money then goes through to the custodian of that that ETF. So they're the ones that essentially look after it and look after the assets.
Yeah.
And so they're holding it on behalf. It's not BlackRock themselves.
So they've got the servers. They've got the storage.
Yeah. Yep. And this is within cryptocurrency circles, you know, and Bitcoin circles, because it is kind of important to somewhat to differentiate the two. But they often, the point of concern is at the moment, one of the most used custodians is Coinbase in the US, which some people might be a bit more familiar with. They've definitely been more prominent in the news than anywhere else. And they are highly used as a custodian for most of these ETFs, bar about two or three. And so that is kind of where some of the concern is, that, you know, often a lot of the risk in the past with Bitcoin has been with custodians doing a poor job of holding it and essentially, you know, the funds being stolen by some malevolent third party who's managed to kind of break into that custodian system. Not so much actually it being an issue with Bitcoin itself, it's to do with you know, their own pass, the company's password and how they access it. So, yeah, it's certainly quite a different structure and quite a much more rigorous structure than what some of these other custodians have operated with in the past, which was virtually no security at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still definitely some hesitancy out there from it.
Can Bitcoin, can cryptocurrency, we understand the division between them, can cryptocurrency be repurposed? Because I thought that blockchain thing always anchored it back to the actual owner. So if you steal it, how do you kind of launder it out?
Well, that's the thing. So if it's taken, it has to go from one address to another. Now, every address is public. And there might be a cryptocurrency or two out there where that's some sort of form of obscuring it that I'm not aware of. But basically, that's a key function of blockchain, is that it's publicly visible, these different addresses. Now, the thing that can be difficult to know is who controls which address. So, you know, there's partial anonymity there. There's, you know, everyone can see where it's gone to, which address it has gone to, but it's not necessarily obvious who controls it. So that's where sometimes it can be still difficult to track down where funds have gone to.
And I suppose regulators will have to develop tools and methods to track that information, and with you know, resulting sort of success to if it's criminal, to get to the criminals.
Yeah, well, that's where some of the back and forth discussion and concern lies, right? So on one hand, you know, people want to be able to ensure that, you know, if their funds are stolen, they're able to be returned. But there's also, I guess, the concern on, because the design of cryptocurrency was to be decentralized. And so if now you're bringing some element of centralization to it, there's concern that it's, you know, kind of undermining the purpose. So it's this constant tension that doesn't have a perfect answer right now. But it's certainly, as cryptocurrency as a area in general continues to grow in interest, it's becoming more and more, I guess, more and more pressure on regulators to have some, you know, process and legislation in place around it.
Mm.
That's why it's getting really topical in the US.
Couple of other stories related to this. El Salvador's bold Bitcoin adoption brings $31 million profit after 3 years. When it says El Salvador's bold Bitcoin adoption, what does that actually mean?
So El Salvador, several years ago, and I remember being fascinated by it at the time. They made the bold call of accepting Bitcoin as legal tender. They were the first country in the world to do that. As far as I know, I think they're still the only one to actually have it as a legal tender. So if you're staying in a hotel over there, you can pay in Bitcoin.
Right.
A lot of the time, what they're doing is live pegging it back to the dollar. So it's kind of, you know, semi-fake paying in Bitcoin. They're actually just accepting the Bitcoin and immediately transferring it into US dollars. But there is that ability. And what the government has been doing there is they've been buying at least one Bitcoin every day and just accumulating. Because El Salvador doesn't actually have their own currency. They had some big issues in the past inflation-wise. They ended up switching to using the US dollar. And so based on really what their president, Nayib Bukele, is saying.
He's quite a cool guy, it seems.
Very interesting guy.
Yeah.
There's a huge variety of opinions on him. I think there's a lot that he's done that's very brave.
Yeah.
Either brave or stupid, I guess time will tell, right? If you're going to, you know, allow Bitcoin to be legal tender, that's, you know, and to be the first country to do it, it's whenever you're doing anything that's a huge shift in thinking or in status quo, you have to be either brave or stupid to do it, right? So, yeah. You know, the future will decide history, right?
It's been very hard on crime too.
Indeed.
In that country, that's not easy because of organized crime, and it's at a way higher level than we could ever imagine. And
yes,
he's made a dent in that too.
Well, I've read a lot of articles, and usually the articles are either extreme in one way or the other, that he's either, you know, the second coming of Christ, or he's Satan himself.
Not
much in between. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to criticize what a country has done when, you know, you're not familiar with actually what it's like to be like that.
Yeah.
Huge incarceration rate. But yeah, the stats thus far are showing that it's had a huge impact on murders. I think their murder rate's now lower than Canada's.
Yeah, it's going way down.
Yeah. So absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Easy to sit in the seat here in New Zealand while we've got, you know, our own problems, nowhere near the problems that they've had. Yeah. And very easy to sit here and judge. So yeah, I definitely prefer to reserve judgment and just digest the information.
How much is one Bitcoin that you're buying? One? Did you say one a day or one a month? Or what was the ratio?
They were buying one a day, yeah.
What's that worth?
That's been the aim. Right now, if I look at the live market, it's about $57,400 US.
Right.
So almost 100K NZ.
Yeah. So they're spending about $250,000 just over a week on it.
Give or take, yes,
yeah. Okay.
A little bit more than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, what the article is essentially saying is that since they've started that program in US dollar terms, you know, they've made, what was it, about $21 million, $31 million after 3 years if they were to sell it all for US dollars. But I don't think that's their plan. But yeah, they're not the only ones that have been really diving into this. Businesses are starting to look more at holding Bitcoin on the balance sheet, and there's none that are better known for it than MicroStrategy, which is a company not well known in general unless you're interested in cryptocurrency. And what their CEO, Michael Saylor, did was he made a decision about 3-4 years ago to basically just start converting the balance sheet into being entirely Bitcoin. And as a result, since then, they've actually been the best performing company on the S&P in the US. They've even outperformed NVIDIA, or at least it was until a recent update. They might be slightly, maybe a few percent behind just a recent update. But without doing anything special with their business, just being a decent software business, their business is actually worth far more than what they actually do. It's almost entirely driven by the fact that they just buy and hold Bitcoin and they take on board debt to buy more. And it has been
a smart move.
Pretty successful. Well, it's been very successful for their shareholders.
Mm.
Even more interesting than that is you've got countries now buying MicroStrategy for their pension funds. So Norway, who are pretty well known as being pretty savvy investors from the use of those oil funds, they've been buying shares in MicroStrategy into their pension fund. South Korea has been doing similar, and Switzerland has also been doing the same, who are obviously not known for being stupid investors or
money-wise. No.
So there's just been really large growing adoption. This is all in the last
Should we
months.
Be doing that? Are we doing that here?
New Zealand isn't. There doesn't seem to really be any politicians interested in the conversation. I heard anecdotally from a client who was sat in the airport lounge with Luxon,
yep.
Who asked directly about New Zealand's thoughts on that, and it seemed to be not that interested at this stage.
How could you not be interested? Sorry, but
yeah,
I mean, I want these people thinking ahead, you know, and working out how we can become better off, and you know, really actively engaging in the at least the thinking, and be prepared to talk about it.
Yep. Yeah, I think there is quite an absence of discussion on it in New Zealand politics, and I think at the next election, my prediction is it's going to be much more topical. It actually wouldn't surprise me if there's either a party that is pretty much founded around it, or a existing party, be they in government or not, that really takes up the mantle of having as a key part of their, I guess, manifesto, would you call it, or whatever, what do they call their sort of...
Policy plans, lineup or whatever, policy.
Exactly.
Yeah, see, if I was in the Koru Club getting the free bacon and eggs and coffee or whatever and smoozing around, my first thing would be, well, you know, El Salvador's doing this.
I guess,
you know,
the story, well, the perspective that many people still hold on El Salvador is it's some, you know, nobody country out there in the world. But yeah, fascinating to see a country take that stance and boldly go where no others are.
Fascinating topic, Joel. Really interesting to talk about and find out about. And if anyone has any queries about it, you're up for answering them, right, at Radical Investment.
Yeah.
They can email you, get in contact, right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So I have quite a few clients that since these Bitcoin ETFs have been launched have had a lot of interest and inquiry around and have helped people with that. So, but just in general, I always love having a conversation with people. I might not be able to, you know, advise on a specific area that they want to talk about, but always happy to have a conversation because I think this area is going to continue to grow in options that are available to people. And I think it's just an important area, an interesting area to keep on top of.
Yeah, absolutely. Joel Robinson from Radical Investment, Wellington-based financial advisor. Thank you for coming on our Money Talks again, Joel. Always great to talk with you. And we'll see you in a few weeks from now, huh?
Thanks, Paul. Looking forward to it.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.